Welcome to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy with Brent Lee and Neil Sanders. This is the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. On the 22nd of May, 2017, Salman Abedi detonated a bomb in the foyer of the Manchester Arena at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing 22 people and injuring hundreds more. A conspiracy theory claiming that this bombing was hoaxed and everyone involved was a crisis actor soon became a dominant narrative in the conspirasphere. One of the main proponents of this theory is Richard D. Hall. Over the course of this series, we will be examining the claims made by Richard D. Hall, as told in his book and documentary, Night of the Bang. Please be aware, this series will be examining a deadly bombing, and we will be discussing details of death and injury. Listener discretion is advised. This is part two.
Richard then moves on to Salman Abedi, who's the purported suicide bomber that is responsible for the atrocity. Richard says,
"Another aspect which points to foreknowledge and proves the official narrative is impossible is the choice of the supposed perpetrator."
And he points out the former MI5 officer, David Shaler. You know David, don't you, Brent?
Yeah, I do know David. Yeah. We actually interviewed him back in 2013, 2014, maybe.
Does he still think he's Jesus?
I think so. Yeah, he does. He condemned me to hell, actually. I'm going to hell, and all my relatives are going to burn in hell as well.
I'm just hoping we're not included in the relatives. Relatives, not friends and relatives, right?
In case people don't know who David Shaler was, David Shaler was a former MI5 agent, and he and another agent called Annie Michon, they wrote a book called Spies, Lies and Whistleblowers, which basically talked about certain newspapers having intelligence agencies infiltrate them to direct stories or to quash other stories and to, you know, basically have some sort of tacit control over mainstream media. I think he went to prison for it, and later his life has been a bit of a roller coaster. At one point, he thought he was Jesus. At another point, he became trans for a short time, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he was Deborah at that time.
Yeah, that was it, Deborah. But I don't think he's Deborah anymore, is he? He's just boring old Jesus now.
He's King David. He's David, the Messiah.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the proof that he's the Messiah, is that his name is David.
Well, I mean, what more do you need? it's obvious when you say it out loud, actually. But anyway, former MI5 officer David Shaler has stated that Salman Abedi's father was an MI6 asset, codenamed Tunworth, and was paid for an attempt to murder Gaddafi in 1996. And so Richard says that we can assume that Salman was an intelligence asset. This is absolutely true. His father was part of the Libyan Islamic Defense Force and potentially part of a group called the Martyrs Brigade that were essentially financed and trained by MI6 and used to fight against Gaddafi in Libya. When certain aspects failed, which we'll talk about later, a huge amount of these people were taken from Libya and were extradited and essentially given sanctuary in an estate in London and an estate in Manchester. And this is absolutely 100% true. There's a group of former Libyan freedom fighters that were later described by the government as terrorists that all live in the same estate. One in Manchester, one in London. There's a sitcom there somewhere, isn't there? So anyway, did Salman try and run away? So basically, he suggests that actually the suicide bomber didn't die. And this is another aspect of why the official narrative is impossible. And he talks about Manchester Police Comms and British Transport Police Sergeant 2202. And this is recorded on his radio channel.
BTT Sergeant 2202 has been approached by mail. He said it was an Asian male, put down a rucksack and ran out of the area. Can I give you a description?
6694, go ahead.
Yeah, it's an Asian male described as, just stand by, just get it, wearing glasses, black baseball cap, and it was a large black rucksack which he said was hidden by the wall.
And if you look at the photographs of Salman Abedi on that day, that's exactly what he's wearing. Black coat, black hat, glasses, black hair, big black rucksack. And that was not the only person that, saw something similar like this. British Transport Police Dale Alcock, badge number 2032, said on the BBC's Night of the Bomb programme,
"There was a gentleman, family man, he was with his daughters. I asked him, I said, what's happened? And he said, there's a guy, I knew there was something wrong with him. He said he threw his bag and there was a large explosion and he ran off. I'm thinking, right, he's at large."
Now, Richard also got an email from a chap that he said saw police pictures of the aftermath that had not been released to the general public. And he said,
"The third source is a witness who contacted me in 2018 and claimed he had witnessed police photographs of the aftermath of the bang. And in his interview with me, he said, it's not a suicide bomber because there was a massive scorch mark up the wall. There was no torso, no legs, no anything, no blood up the wall. There was just a massive scorch mark up the wall."
Now, according to the mainstream explanation, Salman Abedi's body, well, some of it, was found outside the doors of the arena. So he detonated the bomb inside, his legs stayed inside, and his torso from the waist up was ejected through the glass doors and was found on the actual street. That's the mainstream version. Richard says that that's a cover-up, that basically dropped the bag and ran out the doors. And so they've contrived this, essentially. And there is further evidence to support his contention. Richard says not only did the suspect flee the scene, but he was witnessed getting out of a car shortly before the bomb happened.
6694. So reading the log, we've had a call from the public saying a short while ago he saw an Asian male get out of a grey Audi, get a rucksack on his back and run off in the direction of the arena.
Now, this is true. A member of the public saw this Audi. The registration number was FV050P0. And somebody saw an Asian man get out of this car 200 yards from the Manchester Arena, put a rucksack on and run towards the arena. Later that night, the car is followed and tracked by various members of the police. And just after midnight, they approached the car and they didn't want to touch it because they thought it was booby-trapped. And so they sort of left it alone. In the interim, someone's come back and got in that car and driven around Manchester. And about an hour and a half later, at midnight, he's pulled over by armed police. Now, what Richard suggests is the case is that that is the car that Salman Abedi's arrived in. He's escaped. People have assumed he's blown himself up. And then later, he's been caught pretty much again about 200 yards away from the Manchester Arena in this grey Audi by armed police.
Is there a video, I think, of this being pulled over or like some teenagers maybe filming it across the street?
Yeah, it's someone filming it on their phone. Armed police do pull over this grey Audi. You can't see who's in it. And they pulled them over in Manchester just after midnight on the night that the bomb happened. So this is true. The car was there. And Richard speculates that this is more plausible to him, that Salman Abedi actually escaped and got away in the car. So again, interesting if true, and it's all starting to sort of undermine the mainstream case to a degree. He then goes on to say, well, what actually caused the bang? Now, this is an interesting point too, because the police say that what was used is TATP, or sometimes called Mother of Satan. Now, TATP, you can make it using bleach. You have to boil down bleach. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that film, Four Lions.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right film.
Yeah. TATP is the one that's used in that. And so you'll know it's incredibly unstable. You can blow it up just by knocking it and stuff like that. Now, TATP became the sort of the explosive du jour of these peroxide bomb. Now, these debates in the real world as to how effective this is, how easy it is to make, how dangerous it is to make, et cetera, et cetera. But Richard does make a very valid point that according to most sources, TATP makes what's called an entropic explosion. And an entropic explosion means that It's just a shockwave. There's no flame. There's no flash. There's no heat. All of that energy is expelled in the shockwave. It doesn't actually happen before. Whereas numerous witnesses say that they saw a flash or felt heat. In fact, there was a man that was parked in his car about 200 meters away from the Manchester Arena, and he caught the actual flash of the explosion on his dash cam. So it was that big and that bright that he recorded it on his dash cam. And UK Critical Thinker did some experiments to see if this was plausible. And basically, they say, yeah, like you can hear it, even if it was a firework or whatever, you'd be able to see the flash from where this car is and you'd be able to hear the bang. But basically, that's interesting because that shouldn't be a thing. The point about TATP is it can be made at home, and it was basically the chosen explosive that was used by a lot of so-called Islamic terrorists. Whether this is true is a completely other thing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It came up so many times, like in lots of these false flag terror events.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think maybe they used it in 7/7. I'll have a look.
But here's the thing, depending on how you want to look at it, right? Okay, either that's their signature sort of go-to because everyone can make it, so they'll use that explosion, or it becomes a bit of a trope. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, leaving Qurans all over the place or whatever, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
TATP.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Can't remember that, when that was the thing with the 9/11 bombers, that they'd been out looking at strippers and stuff like that and doing coke. So, yeah. So Richard basically says that he thinks that the use of TATP is a lie.
What is TATP? Did you say triacetone, triperoxide?
That's it. Yeah, yeah. But I didn't say that because I couldn't remember it. But
yeah,
yeah. It is that, yeah.
So 7/7 was TATP as well.
Really? 7/7? Yeah, okay. Interesting. I'm guessing the peroxide is, the bleachy type thing.
Yeah, you boil it down, basically, and it becomes like a sort of paste.
That sounds very dangerous.
It's incredibly dangerous. In fact, there is that bit in Four Lions where he's got the shopping bags full of it and trips over and blows himself up. And that can happen.
It's a massive spoiler, but still, it's still a great film. You should all see it. I watched that years ago. God, it's good. It's satire on levels that really just... It's quantum satire.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Anyway, Richard also spoke to a roadie that was working there at the night, and he says that the bloke was definitely there because he's seen him in pictures that were taken by the mainstream media outside helping supposed wounded people. And basically, the roadie said, when the concert ended, we all walked on stage to start taking the drum kit down. We heard a bang, which we thought was a flight case falling over, and the stage manager's radio started going ballistic, and there was panic and pandemonium in the arena. No one knew what had gone on. The stage manager said, right, everybody out of the building. And as you cross stage, probably a 50-yard walk to the loading bay and out of the back staff entrance. So it would take, a minute or so? As we come out of the loading bay, 8 armed police come running past. Now, what Richard is pointing out is that there's a discrepancy here because the Kerslake report says that the police didn't arrive for about 10 minutes, whereas this roadie seems to be saying that basically about 1 to 5 minutes later, he's seen all these armed police come in. And so Richard just says, the armed police were obviously already there. This is an indication that they were expecting it. And a further indication that this is planned and part of a hoax.
And also one of the things just is that like armed police in the UK is a rare thing. So for international listeners who are used to basically having handguns, machine guns and God knows whatever else, generally speaking, anything more than a baton is very abnormal in the UK. So
sometimes they have tasers now, but you have to go on a training course to do tasers.
Very spicy. Yeah. Everyone gets a Glock here, baby. Everyone gets a Glock. Don't you worry. You got yourself a Glock. You pass your course, you get a Glock.
Richard then goes on to speculate that all of the show sex staff must have been in on it, and that's an explanation as to why none of them died. Which, again, that's a bold thing to say, but, like, whatever, if he says that. Now, here's the main bit of evidence, and I have to admit, this was the thing when I first watched it, and I went, oh. EXIF data. Does everyone know what EXIF data is?
Yeah.
EXIF data is metadata that comes off of a photograph. So basically, when you take any photograph, There is a degree of data that is attached to that photo that shows where in the world you were when it was taken, what time it was taken. It's all tied to sort of GPS calendars and stuff like that. Now, the main picture is the one that we've talked about previously from the that was taken by the homeless gentleman, Chris Parker. Now, although the photo does show blood, bodies supposedly in debris, Richard says, like, it could be a staged photo. There's no proof that anybody lying down in their own bodily fluids is actually dead. It could be like a setup. And to be fair, that could be true. But now here's the main thing. This forms the absolute crux of Richard's theory. UK critical thinker got the EXIF data for the image, which is the digital information about when the picture was taken. Now, the date and the time says that the picture was taken on the 22nd of May, 2017, and the time that it was taken was 07/11/18.
So the morning.
The morning, yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
07. So the EXIF data says that this photograph was taken at apparently 7 a.m., 10 past 7 in the morning.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
That, well, yeah.
Richard points out that basically that's 15 hours early. That's 15 hours before the actual event took place. And he says that the mobile phone would have automatically recorded this data. You can't get any muck about with it.
No, you really can't.
And he says that in 2017, it was very unusual for mobile phones, that sort of data, to be incorrect. So Richard's theory off the back of this is that there were two events. There was an event at 7:11 in the morning where the foyer was utilized in order to show this. And then there was a later, when the concert happened, they set off a firework, closed off the foyer so that nobody could get in. And all the footage that you see was actually filmed in the morning. And the main supporting bit of evidence, there's another bit of evidence that supports this, according to Richard, is the EXIF data that shows that the photograph was, according to Richard, taken at 7:11 a.m. on the morning of the 22nd.
That's a good theory.
And we've looked at it. We looked at it. It's not been Photoshopped. There is metadata that has that exactly on it.
Okay.
22nd of the 5th, 2017, 07/11/18.
Wow.
So he's not lying. He's absolutely 100% not lying. That is compelling.
That is compelling. That's a strong point.
Later, UK critical thinkers found the image again and noticed that it had been changed to say that the creation date was 3:11, which is still wrong. 3:11 a.m. the following day, which is still wrong. And he found another version of it that had the creation date of 4 a.m. Okay. And so this is what's confusing him. He says that he's got lots of different dates that are all, some are massively after the fact, but the main one is 15 hours before, and they cannot find an explanation for that. Okay. Now, Richard then shows the 43-second John Barr film, you know, the footage with the lady walking across, and he says that he's checked it frame for frame. It matches the Chris Parker photo. So that film must have been filmed at 7 in the morning. Must have been, if Richard is correct about that, then it must have been. And there's a further piece of evidence that he suggests.
When the camera pans to the left, we briefly see one of the foyer glass doors which lead to the Victoria Station walkway. On the far left-hand side, we see the glass door with what appears to be daylight entering. I have identified what we are seeing through the glass door looking out onto the walkway. The white rectangle of light is coming through the train station's ETFE panels, and we also see the canopy, the walkway railing, and the walkway. I conclude that the video was filmed during the hours of daylight.
And what he's talking about is it pans to the left and we see the glass door and there's like an oblong of light. In fact, I'll find the picture so I can show you. I don't know if you can, you won't be able to see that, but here.
Okay. Yeah. No, I can see that. Yep.
Like that oblong of light is on the door. And basically he says that that's light coming in, the 7 a.m. morning light coming in from the walkway.
It's bright light. Yeah. And it's May too. So yeah, no. It's not like a summer where you guys have like a late daylight savings. It's May.
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. So if it was at 10 o'clock at night, there would be no daylight outside. Absolutely. And he says, I have identified that what we're seeing through the glass door looking onto the walkway, the white rectangle of light is coming through the train station ETFE panels. And we also see the canopy of the walkway, the railing and the walkway. I conclude that the video was filmed during the hours of daylight. Now, he also looks at the skylight. Now, if you go on Google Earth, there's a big skylight above the foyer and it's covered over. There's like a tarpaulin over it. Now, the mainstream media said that was happened after the fact because they were repairing it. But Richard wonders if they put the tarpaulin on beforehand to stop the light coming in through the thing. So again, that the EXIF data is strong evidence, is compelling. And when I first saw that, that was the bit that I could not get my head around. It was like, wow, that certainly seems to show that the footage was taken at 7 a.m.
400 pages, mate. 400 pages.
Mm.
What can you do, mate? Like, it's...
Well...
Yeah.
Now, although there are 400 pages in the book, most of it is dedicated to something which is called... And we'll come on to the book because we've got to go through all the victims and stuff like that. A surprising amount of it is dedicated to something called statement analysis. Essentially, we get 67 pages in and then the statement analysis starts.
Okay.
And the statement analysis doesn't stop until... page 407.
Oh,
so
wow.
So you see all this bit.
That's like the meat of the book.
That says a lot. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The majority of it is statement analysis from a lady called Genevieve Lewis.
One person?
Yeah. He often uses a person called Peter Hyatt, who also does the very same thing. And it's about looking at people's and listening to the way that they talk, looking at the way that they distance themselves from stories, the use of pronouns, the use of tenses and stuff. And the theory is that this can tell if somebody's lying or not.
It's a forensic analysis as such.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm waiting.
Well, then before we come on to it, so part two of Richard's film, and it starts with a title card that says, who was involved? And Richard reiterates that the pictures that we see were taken at 7:11 a.m., not 10:31 in the evening. And, you know, he's got his evidence for that. The light, the EXIF data, fair enough.
As we have seen, the images and video so far released showing the alleged foyer aftermath were taken shortly after 7 a.m. on the 22nd of May 2017, not at 22:31 when the bang happened. This means there has been no video or images released showing the foyer after 22:31. Considering there were over 100 people alleged to be inside the foyer, this is an incredible fact and suggests that those inside the foyer were following instructions not to record or release images.
So basically, in his book, he lists on page 407, these are the people that supposedly died in the foyer. Philip Tron, Courtney Boyle, Marcin Kliss, Angelica Kliss, Liam Curry, Chloe Rutherford, Alison Howe, Lisa Lees, Eileen McIver, Michelle Kiss, Wendy Fall, Safi Roussos, Sorel Lakowski, Jane Tweddle, Kelly Brewster, Eileen McLeod, Nell Jones, Olivia Campbell, Megan Hurley, John Atkinson, Martin Hay, and Georgina Callender. And these people were injured in the foyer. Martin Hibbert, Eve Hibbert, Amelia Thompson, Andy Hawley, Adam Lawler, Emma Johnson, Emma Johnson's husband, Andrea Bradbury, Lisa Roussos, Robbie Potter, Leonora Ogerio, Abby Mullen, Lisa Kane, Nick Bickerstaff, John Barr, Alex Brown, Chris Coulter, Philip Hassel, Robert Grew, Paul Reed, Darren Costa, Adrian Thorpe, and the British Transport Police. So not all of those were injured, but they were in the foyer. Now, what Richard says is that all of those people, lying. None of them were in the foyer. None of them were in the foyer that evening. In fact, he goes on to suggest that by that time in the evening, some of them were probably on planes leaving the country, starting their new lives. So he's saying that basically all these people are lying, and he's basing that on the EXIF data and everything else.
We therefore have no record or evidence of who was present and of what happened at 22:31. The only thing we have is what those in the foyer have said. I refer to these people as participants, and in order to explore their testimonies, I set about creating a database of participants containing the names of all the people who claim they were inside the foyer or very near the foyer at the time of the bang. I've split the first database into four sections. They are the alleged deceased, the seriously injured. Note here, I am defining serious as their injuries prevented them from fleeing the scene. Then we have non-seriously injured, or those with minor injuries who fled the scene, and finally, the unharmed, which included 5 SMC staff.
And in the book, it's slightly different. It's dead, injured, uninjured, and inside the arena or at another location. But the point is, he's trying to break down and go through everybody that was there, or as many people as possible, to try and get a picture of what actually happened. He lists those with serious injuries and says that they were too injured to leave the foyer. So there were 30 plus 4 who claimed to have had broken ankles, and there was also 22 dead or dying. So Richard says that there should have been about 52 odd people in the foyer. But he plays the radio comms for Inspector Mike Smith, who is the senior officer involved in the response, and he says,
6694, go ahead.
Okay, for you. We're in the city office, which is sort of over the bridge from the main entrance of Victoria Station so far.
What's that?
Looks to me like a bomb's gone off here. I would say there's about 30 casualties.
Richard then shows another soundbite from paramedic Lee Vaughan, who says,
the most patients I've ever dealt with in my career is three at once. So being faced with 26 patients to deal with.
And Richard says that basically, look, these are supposed to be professionals. How have they missed 20 people in their assessment of what's going on? He also points out that Nick Bickerstaff had said that there were 60 to 80 people hanging around, and the correct number was actually 109. There was supposedly at any one time 109 people in that foyer. So there's discrepancies there that he's picking up on. And he says he wonders how these discrepancies can be explained. Then an incredibly sensitive title card comes up that just simply says, The Dead. And Richard says,
statements from witnesses commenting on those who were dead or dying is severely lacking.
There is a reason why you've not got statements from the dead. But let's not split hairs at this point.
Our analysis suggests that there is no reliable testimony describing the dead or the dying victims in the foyer. Did the deceased victims only take part in the mourning exercise? If we assume that none of those who it was claimed had died were present in the foyer during the evening event, then the numbers make a lot more sense. Was the purpose of the morning drill to take photographs of those that had allegedly died in position on the floor and then only work with the injured during the actual event? This would give deceased victims time to catch a flight out of the country before the concert started, if the plan was for them to start a new life. There is a complete lack of reliable photographs showing deceased victims inside the foyer or at the arena, either before or after their alleged death. I don't believe any of the deceased were present in the foyer.
Richard says that there's no evidence that anyone died and that funerals are not proof. He says that most of the 22 have been relocated, some died earlier, and some were used as participants. And he found that most of the dead have got some sort of connection to another country.
After researching all of the alleged deceased, I have theorized about how it was possible for their families to accept or consent to them starting new lives in other countries and agreeing to having their deaths fabricated.
And he breaks it down to like these 4 different categories.
The previously deceased victim is a participant who it has been claimed died at the Manchester Arena, but in fact died sometime before the concert in an accident or other scenario, probably very shortly before the 22nd of May.
And one of those, which we'll come on to later, he suggests that Safi Roussos, who's 8, she didn't die at the concert. She died in other circumstances at her home before the event, and they used her death to pretend.
Can I get 1 second here to say that, can I just guess and say, is Israel going to turn up here?
It does at some point, yeah.
Yeah. Just going to say, I just feel like Israel coming. I just feel like Israel's like in the wings. I feel there's an Israel coming in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know, maybe I'm jaded.
Yeah, well, you know, Islamic terrorism, they usually tie in Israeli, like, intelligence.
There's a thing, you know, there's a trope, right? So I'm just saying, I'm going with my gut here, right? Because I've been scarred by Nazis.
You can feel it in your waters.
I'm kind of broken.
So the second category is what's called the apprentice child.
The apprentice child is a participant who is approaching school leaving age and expressed a wish to carry out some ambition, education, or goal. Their dream has been granted, and the child or young adult has been sent somewhere away from their parents' home to achieve their ambition. The parents have received money to keep silent about where their child is now living.
So, for example, there's certain kids that were expressed interest in music or architecture or something like that. He says that they've been whisked away to various other places on a scholarship to do this magical thing that they'll never get an opportunity to do again. Flip side of that contract is they have to pretend to be somebody else forever. He says that the no ties victim
is a participant with no strong family ties and has agreed to start a new life with a new identity, probably in another country. This could be a young adult, a young couple with no children, or a middle-aged adult whose children have grown up.
And then finally, he says, the surrogate victim
is a child or young adult who has been placed in the care of another family in a different part of the world. It is not uncommon for foster children to be reassigned new parents to look after them.
Now, what's interesting is, of the 22 dead, he doesn't assign anybody the surrogate victim. So I don't know why he bothered with that category. He only uses three of the four categories that he's presented.
Yeah.
So I don't know why he did that, but he did. Anyway. But he says,
if one of them started to talk, firstly, it's unlikely they'd be given any significant media platform to express their view, so people would probably not find out. Secondly, it is likely they are being monitored and at any time can be reminded of the contract they agreed to, which could include penalties. Others argue, why not just kill the victims and create real deaths? Creating real deaths creates protest from real relatives. If the event is a charade, relatives don't protest because their loved ones have not been harmed. They take their money and keep quiet.
So essentially, he's accusing bereaved parents of lying about their dead children for money, which is, again, a bold claim.
It's way more compelling than the idea of, like, sort of, you know, we'll kill them all, or there's like this, like, you know, weird sort of, like, you know, Hollywood style control with like a cleaner who wears blue gloves or some bullshit. You just pay everyone to shut the fuck up. But at the same time, in a situation like this, it kind of like, I can see where he's coming from. Look, I'm not loving it, but I can see where this is coming from.
It's getting more complicated as it goes on because of the more people involved.
Well, it always does because it gets more people involved, more exponentially complicated. But the way you can explain this, the fact that everyone's like middle class, fairly bored, they've got an opportunity to do something and they've been paid to do it. It's an opportunity. It's like you win the lottery, you don't tell anyone, right? It's two sides of the same coin. So like, I'm not excusing the theories and I'm not trying to find reasons to justify it, but I'm playing this out by face value, and I get where this is coming from.
He then moves on to the injured. Richard states that all of the images of the injured could have actually occurred prior to the bang, and basically using real injuries to give the impression that they're actually bomb victims.
Whoa.
He says that all the pictures taken by the media could be fake too. They could include like fake bandages, fake blood, very much like we saw right at the beginning with the strategic communications scenes, you know, blood kits and stuff like that. And he points to one particular lady called Ruth Morell. And there's a bit where she's being interviewed by the Queen. She's the woman that's seen in the John Barr video walking past, and she's got a great big sort of hole in a thigh with blood coming down it, but she seems to be walking unimpinged. And she says to the Queen, it's nuts and bolts that everyone seems to be having. Mine's gone 15 centimetres out the other side. And she's wandering around, obviously, in this video in bloodstained jeans. As Richard says, her walk exhibits no signs of a limp. She puts her full weight on each foot. As we see, there is a stain in the place where her leg was alleged to be injured. There is no sign that anything entered or exited. Her jeans would have been more torn than they are. And then she's later pictured outside after the bomb in the evening. And Richard says that the stain looks really different there, like the blood's dried. So what he's implying is that she's basically been wearing her costume all day.
Okay,
and
the blood
looks different in the evening. Now, this is where he introduces Genevieve Lewis. Genevieve Lewis is the statement analyst, and she has analysed the speech of various people in order to see if they are lying. Now, this is the thing that we're talking about, scan or statement analysis. Now, statement analysis involves an investigator searching for linguistic cues and gaps in a subject's testimony or preliminary statements. Ideally, the technique would guide investigators to ask follow-up questions and uncover discrepancies. Now, the creator of scientific content analysis, or SCAN, Avin Comsapir, gives an example of somebody saying, "Well, I counted the money and I put the bag on the counter and proceeded to go home." And Sapir says, "You'll notice that they're not lying in this statement. He counted the money because when you steal the money, you want to know how much there is. And he put the bag on the counter, but he didn't say he put the money back on the counter in the bag because he didn't. He left with the bag." And so the idea is that basically people tend to tell the truth, but they'll use certain sort of words to distance themselves from the truth because it's more difficult to lie. So if you technically tell the truth but omit facts that would make you seem guilty, that's a way of lying, essentially.
Lying by omission.
Yeah, yeah. And Sapir says that a fundamental principle of a statement analysis is that denying guilt is not the same as denying the act. When one says, "I am not guilty" or "I am innocent," they are not denying the act, they are just denying guilt. And Sapir claims that it is almost impossible for a guilty person to simply say, "I didn't do it." And he asserts that guilty people tend to speak in even greater circumlocutions by saying things like, "I had nothing to do with it," or "I'm not involved in that," rather than saying, "I didn't do it," or "I'm not guilty."
So it's kind of like when people analyze body language, but they're actually analyzing your language.
Yes, in fact, statement analysis is actually quite favored by certain body language proponents. There's I can't remember his name, he's on the telly quite a lot, rather large guy, and he's a massive fan of Peter Hyatt. He says that Peter Hyatt's work on The McCanns, for example, which was actually a Richard film, he says that shows all sorts of really, really interesting things. And SCAN is like taken seriously by some people. Law enforcement agencies in all 50 states have actually received SCAN training in America.
See, that's what my interesting is in the idea of this. Does this follow into law enforcement or law in general? Because I'm doing evidence at the moment at university. I'm studying law, and I must say this sounds like bullshit. So when it comes to the evidence law we have, which is basically built from common law, which is, thanks you guys, you brought it over, it's not ringing bells for me. So when you say the 50 states, I'm assuming you're saying the 50 states of America, where they're, I'm not going to say idiots, but we love our American listeners, but we're going to say susceptible to theatrics.
Well, I mean, it's also used prominently in the Netherlands. It's also been used in the past, by the FBI. And there has been SCAN training from the official SCAN website agency in Australia.
Oh, that hurts me.
In Belgium, in Canada, in Israel, in Mexico, in Singapore, South Africa, and the UK. In fact, in America, 417 different police forces have received SCAN training.
I'm just going to say right now, from what I'm studying in evidence law, if I heard any of that bullshit, I would not be putting that in my essay. I'm just telling you that right now, man.
Well, what Sapir, who's the creator of SCAN, he says that sifting truth from deception is easy, and you do it by this way. You give the subject a pen and paper. You ask them to write down their version of what happened, and then you analyze the statement and solve the case. Now, according to LSI, which is the SCAN website that has done all these courses all over the world, the validity of SCAN is 95%. That's according to the website.
I'm already thinking of like 9 reasons why in the Evidence Act that's just not admissible, like at all.
Well, Sapir encourages asking a simple open question such as "what happened?" And then the SCAN investigator looks for signs of deception, analysing the pronouns used, the changes in vocabulary, what's left out, how much of the statement is devoted to what happened before or after the event. Indications of truthfulness include the use of the past tense, first-person singular pronouns, which also signal commitment and direct denials. So basically, if you say "I," that tends to be the truth. If you say "we," "they," "us," anything like that, that tends to be a distancing factor and shows the deception. What he says is that signs of deception include a lack of memory, spontaneous corrections, or swapping one word for another. But he also says that the analyst need not know anything about the person or the case. In fact, it's actually preferable, because Sapir writes that outside knowledge can contaminate the analysis. Whether that's going to be important for later on, who can say? But he says that suspects can either write down their statements or have them dictated. Once the statement is obtained, it can be analyzed to determine deception. It follows a two-step process similar to the traditional polygraph. First, the investigator determines what elements are typical for a truthful statement, traditionally referred to in a polygraph's procedure as a control question or a norm. Then the investigation looks for deviation from the norm. But it isn't clear how much deviation is required. The core of statement analysis is an examination of parts of speech, and investigators are taught to examine pronouns, nouns, and verbs to establish the norm for each. Deviation could mean deception. So anyway, this is the thing. So statement analysis, apparently these people that take it seriously, and this is the way that you would do it if you were to do it correctly. So with Ruth Morell, who's the lady that's got the bolt through her leg, she was being interviewed by the Queen, and she says to the Queen, "My daughter, she's just gone down to theatre. Well, she's come out now." And Genevieve Lewis points out that how can she have just gone to the theatre and just come back? It doesn't make any sense. She's changing her story. Ruth Morell then goes on to say, she's only 12 years old. She was with her friend and she'd gone to the concert. And so Genevieve Lewis picks up on that and says,
that doesn't make sense. It should be they'd gone to the concert. There's an error with pronouns here. And pronouns are instinctive. They are intuitive. They are some of the first words we speak from children. Mm. Pronouns are never wrong. With statement analysis, that's one of the main principles, is follow the pronouns. That will tell you an awful lot. There's a mistake here. It should have been they'd gone to the concert. So this tells us that her daughter went to the concert alone.
And Richard says, her daughter's friend, Millie Kiss, mm-hmm. was found outside the arena. Yeah. So we think that that may have been all orchestrated. So
yes.
That would explain why she's on her own.
Yes.
Because Millie was predetermined to be outside, not in the foyer mm-hmm. after the event.
Ruth Morell says, but myself and my daughter's friend were waiting. My daughter's friend, mum, she died. And Genevieve Lewis says this shows distancing, i.e. the signs of lying, and that she and her daughter's friends were together and that she was not friends with the dead woman. And it's like, oh, okay, that's quite a bold statement. And Ruth Morell goes on to say she was one of the ones that got, she died in the blast. And Genevieve Lewis says, one of the ones, those other ones? This is self-editing, and this indicates changing the story. She died in the blast. What would you say about your friend being killed? You would say, my friend got killed. She's already said she died. This is a need to persuade. And Ruth Morell goes on to say, I had one of those wounds as well. And Genevieve Lewis says, yeah is a verbal pause. It gives you time to think, which shouldn't be necessary if you're telling the truth, because the truth simply flows out. These wounds, not this wound, it's distancing language. It's not reliable at all. She said, I had one of those wounds. Does she not still have it? Maybe she only had that wound on the evening, implying that it's a fake wound. And then Genevieve Lewis reiterates, pronouns are always reliable. So then they go on to look at another person injured. This is Martin Hibbert, and this is the person that's actually brought the lawsuit against Richard. Now, Richard sensitively says, right, now let's look at wheelchair victim Martin Hibbert, which is potentially not the kindest way to describe somebody. But Martin is pictured in a wheelchair or sitting. This is the thing. Richard says that he can only find pictures of Martin either in a wheelchair or sitting. But the UK critical thinker found a quote from Martin on a masseuse website for 2014 saying that he suffered from lower back pains. Now, Martin Hibbert claims to have suffered this spinal injury that paralysed him from the waist down from a shrapnel injury. But Richard speculates that actually Martin had a herniated disc. He says,
is it the case that Hibbert does have problems with the use of his legs, but they are due to his long-term spinal issues and not from injuries sustained in a bomb blast?
And Richard shows Martin's scar, which is just to the right of his spine. And he suggests this is actually from a herniated disc operation rather than from a shrapnel wound. And he says that what has happened is that he's clearly been paralyzed by a mistake in this disc operation. And they've then persuaded him to pretend that he was paralyzed in the bomb blast. And he also shows the purported X-ray that Martin Hibbert shows of bolts in his body. And Richard compares it to an X-ray of a man that swallowed a ring. And you can see a marked difference. He says that basically on Martin Hibbert's, there's a weird black edge to the bolts. And he says that he thinks that this is indication of photoshopping. And he says that you can't see the black edge around the ring that's been swallowed. Therefore, the difference indicates some sort of deception to him. Richard then points out that Martin Hibbert has said that he's going to do the Great North Run. And Richard wonders how this is possible if Martin Hibbert is paralyzed. Now, let's just not fuck about with that because that's too stupid for words. He did it in his wheelchair.
Yeah, exactly.
He did it in his wheelchair.
People know. Do
stuff in their wheelchair. We're not even going to entertain that. That is just ridiculous. But anyway.
I didn't know if you wanted to spoil that right now or not. But yeah,
totally. He's too stupid not to. Like, I'm not risking people listening for another 3 hours and going, could Neil really not figure out how he did to train those? Anyway, so Martin says in interviews that he was told that the shrapnel was traveling at 90 miles per hour. And Richard says, well, hang on, tennis players can hit the ball faster than that. How come a tennis ball doesn't stick in your net?
Have you tried?
Well, that's a fair point. But apparently one of the things it went through, it split his jugular vein. It went into his throat. Ooh. And then he swallowed it. And so he still got the bolt inside him.
Apparently. Oh, God.
I don't know actually whether he took it out, but he did have the bolt inside him.
Oh, that's very unpleasant.
Yeah, it's terrible. And what happened to his daughter as well was his daughter, Eve, she got a bolt that went straight through one temple and out the other side. Richard basically wonders why Eve is not in the press. Martin had basically made it a point to not have her photo shown in the press.
Good.
He took her off social media.
Smart.
Well, quite. He didn't want his daughter being harassed by the press, but Richard says this is very, very, very suspicious. He then says that basically what he did was he went to Eve's house. Eve is living with her mother. Richard went to their house to try and film Eve because he doesn't believe that she's disabled. And we'll come on to it in greater detail later, but essentially he set up a hidden camera outside their home in order to catch her out. In the film, he also shows the outside of Nick Bickerstaff's house because he goes to Nick Bickerstaff's house to try and film him and his daughter Ellen because he doesn't believe their story either. But yeah, she had a bolt go through her head and she's had very, very severe brain damage. But Richard, with his expert opinion, says that he doesn't believe that this is possible. Now, both he and Genevieve Lewis, when they do statement analysis, say that Martin is lying about being there on the night and also lying about Eve's injuries. And Genevieve Lewis points out that there's been a paper written about Eve Hibbert's brain injury. And Genevieve Lewis says, why? This is a waste of time because we already know how to treat brain injury. And so what they've done is they've created this paper to bolster the story that this person got brain damage. The bomb is disease fake. Now, what Genevieve Lewis says is that when he talks about the bomb and the night where he was paralyzed and his daughter was brain damaged, that he tends to pause a lot and go quite slowly. But she thinks that this is an indication of lying and distancing. And she says that actually he's remembering lies. Now, what's interesting is they say that we can't really see a lot of deception, but it doesn't add up what he's saying. And a couple of times he's mentioned the word bullet. And what he thinks has happened is that originally the scenario was supposed to be a shooting, a mass shooting, and that Martin was supposed to get shot in the scenario. And they changed it at the last minute. And so why he's so sort of stilted in the way he's telling it is because he was originally supposed to be pretending to be shot, and he's remembering, he's mashing those two sort of learned narratives together.
Right. Yeah, mixing up the two plots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically, Martin had said that he didn't agree with the Kerslake report. When the Kerslake report came out, he says he just doesn't answer any of the questions. He was interviewed by Jon Snow, and he said that the description in the Kerslake report doesn't match what he said happened. And Genevieve Lewis says that this is deceptive. It says that Martin Hibbert says, well, you know, obviously, we know a terrorist detonated a bolt bomb and 22 of these bolts hit me. And Genevieve says, we don't know. It should be I know. The use of we shows that he's lying. So Richard goes on to say, we think it's possible that that's what Hibbert means when he says the Kerslake report isn't what I expected. He was possibly told that he was going to be a hero having been shot, and he's not happy with the narrative that they've come up with. When Jon Snow says what did happen, he has to go along with the mainstream narrative. And with every injury that the MSM reported on, I've been able to show that some are not real or are being exaggerated, and others that are genuine were not obtained in the arena foyer. So that's part two of Richard's film. So, yeah, it's getting into more and more batshit areas, as we can see.
It gets harder as it goes on. That's the issue. It gets exponentially more difficult as you start considering everyone. And this is why when you first said 450 pages, I thought it was very brave. But then when you said that the middle being, you know, the bulk of the book was this analysis, it made me realize that, no, they took a Trojan horse to then distract readers to go down a yellow brick road of absurdity, which still is exponentially absurd, but to not have a linear passage of time, because that makes it more difficult to justify. You need to get into these sort of absurd, minutiae, forensic nonsenses, because otherwise you've got sort of nothing. Look, some of the stuff is interesting. The XF data, I still don't know.
Yep.
That's got me interested, because 7 a.m. isn't 10 p.m. And unless somehow the camera thinks it's fucking Seychelles time zone.
Well, it goes back in time as well. It can't be explained by a different time zone either, because of the 15 hours.
Yeah, there's nowhere in the world that's 15 hours, is it?
Oh, because not even New Zealand, because we're plus 10, and Chicago or like California's like minus like 8 or something like that, because GMT is obviously God's time.
Yeah.
I'm not questioning the fact that you guys are the chosen people of time zones. But what I can say is that what's a minus 14 is the maximum? I'm not sure. I don't know.
If you take into account daylight saving times, you can get as much as 13, I think, but you can't get the 15. Yeah, you cannot get it. It's just not possible.
So, fuck. Oh, I just don't know, man. The XF data is...
We don't know. Who knows, Joel? Maybe we've worked that out.
Well, maybe you fucking have, but I'm the passenger here and you are fucking with my head. So, throw me a gummy right. bear. I'll wait to catch it.
And that concludes part two. Thank you for listening to Some Dare Call It Conspiracy, the Manchester Arena Bombing on Trial series. Tune in next week for part three. And as always, if you subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/somedarecallitconspiracy, you can listen to the full 8-part series right now. Thanks again.